He produced a narrow black leather notebook from the pocket of the blue blazer he wore and gravely noted down each name she mentioned. She looked down at her plate and saw that she had finished all of her cake. Her hands still hurt, but they felt better than they had when she arrived. She recalled that she had almost decided against coming by because they were so miserable. Now she was glad she had done it anyway. "I have to go," she said, looking at her watch. "Rosalie will think I died." They had eaten standing up. Now Gaunt stacked their plates neatly, put the forks on top, and replaced the top on the cake container. "I'll return this as soon as the cake is gone," he said. "Is that all right?" "Perfectly." "You'll probably have it by mid-afternoon, then," he said gravely. "You don't have to be that prompt," she said as Gaunt walked her to the door. "It's been very nice to meet you." "Thanks for coming by," he said. For a moment she thought he meant to take her arm, and she felt a sense of dismay at the thought of his touch. Silly, of course, but he didn't. "You've made what I expected to be a scary day into something of a treat instead." "You'll be fine." Polly opened the door, then paused. She had asked him nothing at all about himself, but she was curious about one thing, too curious to leave without asking. "You've got all sorts of interesting things. Thank you. But nothing is priced. Why is that?" He smiled. "That's a little eccentricity of mine, Polly. I've always believed that a sale worth making is worth dickering over a little. I think I must have been a Middle Eastern rug merchant in my last incarnation." "So you charge whatever the market will bear?" she asked, teasing just a little. "You could say so," he agreed seriously. And again she was struck by how deep his hazel eyes were, how oddly beautiful. "I'd rather think of it as defining worth by need."
"I see.
Do you really?"
"Well, I think so. It explains the name of the shop."
He smiled.
"It might," he said.
"I suppose it might, at that."
"Well, I'll wish you a very good day, Mr. Gaunt.
Leland, please.
Or just Lee?"
"Leland, then, and you're not to worry about customers. I think by Friday you'll have to hire a security guard to shoo them out at the end of the day."
"Do you? That would be lovely. Goodbye."
"Ciao," he said, and closed the door after her. He stood there a moment, watching as Polly Chalmers walked down the street, smoothing her gloves over her hands, so misshapen, and in such startling contrast to the rest of her, which was trim and pretty, if not terribly remarkable. Gaunt's smile grew. As his lips drew back, exposing his uneven teeth, it became unpleasantly predatory. "You'll do," he said softly in the empty shop. "You'll do just fine." Polly's prediction proved quite correct. By closing time that day, almost all of the women in Castle Rock, those who mattered anyway, and several men had stopped by Needful Things for a quick browse. Almost all of them were at some pains to assure Gaunt that they only had a moment because they were on their way to someplace else. Stephanie Bonsaint, Cynthia Rose Martin, Barbara Miller, and Francine Pelletier were the first. Steffi, Cindy Rose, Babs, and Francie arrived in a protective bunch not 10 minutes after Polly was observed leaving the new shop. The news of her departure spread quickly and thoroughly by telephone and the efficient bush telegraph which runs through New England backyards. Steffi and her friends looked. They oohed and aahed. They assured Gaunt they could not stay long because this was their bridge day, neglecting to tell him that the weekly rubber usually did not start until about 2 p.m. Francie asked him where he came from. Gaunt told her Akron, Ohio. Steffi asked him if he had been in the antiques business for long. Gaunt told her he did not consider it to be the antiques business, exactly. Cindy wanted to know if Mr. Gaunt had been in New England long.
"A while," Gaunt replied.
"A while." All four agreed later that the shop was interesting, so many odd things, but it had been a very unsuccessful interview. The man was as closed-mouthed as Polly Chalmers, perhaps more. Babs then pointed out what they all knew, or thought they knew, that Polly had been the first person in town to actually enter the new shop and that she had brought a cake. Perhaps, Babs speculated, she knew Mr. Gaunt,
from that time before, that time she had spent away. Cindy Rose expressed interest in a Lalique vase and asked Mr. Gaunt, who was nearby but did not hover, all noted with approval, how much it was. "How much do you think?" he asked, smiling. She smiled back at him rather coquettishly. "Oh," she said, "is that the way you do things, Mr. Gaunt?" "That's the way I do them," he agreed. "Well, you're apt to lose more than you gain, dickering with Yankees," Cindy Rose said, while her friends looked on with the bright interest of spectators at a Wimbledon championship match. "That," he said, "remains to be seen." His voice was still friendly, but now it was mildly challenging as well. Cindy Rose looked more closely at the vase this time. Steffi Bonsaint whispered something in her ear. Cindy Rose nodded. $17, she said. The vase actually looked as if it might be worth 50, and she guessed that in a Boston antique shop it would be priced at 180. Gaunt steepled his fingers under his chin in a gesture Brian Rusk would have recognized. "I think I'd have to have at least 45, he said with some regret. Cindy Rose's eyes brightened. There were possibilities here. She had originally seen the Lalique vase as something only mildly interesting, really not much more than another conversational crowbar to use on the mysterious Mr. Gaunt. Now she looked at it more closely and saw that it really was a nice piece of work, one which would look right at home in her living room. The border of flowers around the long neck of the vase was the exact color of her wallpaper. Until Gaunt had responded to her suggestion with a price which was only a finger's length out of her reach, she hadn't realized that she wanted the vase as badly as she now felt that she did. She consulted with her friends. Gaunt watched them, smiling gently. The bell over the door rang, and two more ladies came in. At Needful Things, the first full day of business had begun. When the Ash Street Bridge Club left Needful Things 10 minutes later, Cindy Rose Martin carried a shopping bag by the handles. Inside was the Lalique vase, wrapped in tissue paper. She had purchased it for $31 plus tax, almost all of her pin money, but she was so delighted with it that she was almost purring. Usually she felt doubtful and a little ashamed of herself after such an impulse buy, certain that she had been cozened a little, if not cheated outright, but not today. This was one deal where she had come out on top. Mr. Gaunt had even asked her to come back, saying he had the twin of this vase and it would be arriving in a shipment later in the week, perhaps even tomorrow. This one would look lovely on the little table in her living room, but if she had two, she could put one on each end of the mantel, and that would be smashing. Her three friends also felt that she had done well, and although they were a little frustrated at having gotten so little of Mr. Gaunt's background, their opinion of him was, on the whole, quite high. "He's got the most beautiful green eyes," Francie Pelletier said, a little dreamily. "Were they green?" Cindy Rose asked, a little startled. She herself had thought they were gray. "I didn't notice." Late that afternoon, Rosalie Drake from You So-and-So stopped in Needful Things on her coffee break, accompanied by Polly's housekeeper, Nettie Cobb. There were several women browsing in the store, and in the rear corner, two boys from Castle County High were leafing through a cardboard carton of comic books and muttering excitedly to each other. It was amazing, they both agreed, how many of the items they needed to fill their respective collections were here. They only hoped the prices would not prove too high. It was impossible to tell without asking, because there were no price stickers on the plastic bags which held the comics. Rosalie and Polly said hello to Mr. Gaunt, and Gaunt asked Rosalie to thank Polly again for the cake. His eyes followed Nettie, who had wandered away after the introductions and was looking rather wistfully at a small collection of carnival glass. He left Rosalie studying the picture of Elvis next to the splinter of petrified wood from the Holy Land and walked over to Nettie. "Do you like carnival glass, Ms. Cobb?" he asked softly. She jumped a little. Nettie Cobb had the face and almost painfully shy manner of a woman made to jump at voices, no matter how soft and friendly, when they spoke from the general area of her elbow, and smiled at him nervously. "It's Mrs. Cobb, Mr. Gaunt, although my husband's been passed on for some time now." "I am sorry to hear it." "No need to be. It's been 14 years. Long time.
Yes, I have a little collection of carnival glass. She seemed almost to quiver, as a mouse might quiver at the approach of a cat. Not that I could afford anything so nice as these pieces. Lovely they are, like things must look in heaven.
Well, I'll tell you something, he said. I bought quite a lot of carnival glass when I got these, and they're not as expensive as you might think, and the others are much nicer. Would you like to come by tomorrow and have a look at them?
She jumped again and sidled away a step, as if he had suggested she might like to come by the next day so he could pinch her bottom a few times, perhaps until she cried.
Oh, I don't think. Thursday's my busy day, you know, at Polly's. We really have to turn the place out on Thursdays, you know.
Are you sure you can't drop by? He coaxed. Polly told me that you made the cake she brought this morning.
Was it all right? Nettie asked nervously. Her eyes said she expected him to say, no, it was not all right, Nettie. It gave me cramps. It gave me the backdoor trots, in fact. And so I'm going to hurt you, Nettie. I'm going to drag you into the back room and twist your nipples until you holler, Uncle.
It was wonderful, he said soothingly. It made me think of the cakes my mother used to make, and that was a very long time ago. This was the right note to strike with Nettie, who had loved her own mother dearly, in spite of the beatings that lady had administered after her frequent nights out in the juke joints and gin mills. She relaxed a little.
Well, that's fine then, she said. I'm awfully glad it was good. Of course, it was Polly's idea. She's just about the sweetest woman in the world.
Yes, he said. After meeting her, I can believe that.
He glanced at Rosalie Drake, but Rosalie was still browsing. He looked back at Nettie and said, I just felt I owed you a little something.
Oh, no, Nettie said, alarmed all over again. You don't owe me a thing, not a single solitary thing, Mr. Gaunt.
Please, come by. I can see you have an eye for carnival glass, and I could give you back Polly's cake box.
Well, I suppose I could drop by on my break.
Nettie's eyes said she could not believe what she was hearing from her own mouth.
Wonderful, he said, and left her quickly before she could change her mind again. He walked over to the boys and asked them how they were doing. They hesitantly showed him several old issues of The Incredible Hulk and The X-Men. 5 minutes later, they went out with most of the comic books in their hands and expressions of stunned joy on their faces. The door had barely shut behind them when it opened again. Cora Rusk and Myra Evans strode in. They looked around, eyes as bright and avid as those of squirrels in nut-gathering season, and went immediately to the glass case containing the picture of Elvis. Cora and Myra bent over, cooing with interest, displaying bottoms which were easily 2 axe handles wide. Gaunt watched them, smiling. The bell over the door jingled again. The new arrival was as large as Cora Rusk, but Cora was fat, and this woman looked strong, the way a lumberjack with a beer belly looks strong. A large white button had been pinned to her blouse. The red letters proclaimed, Casino Night, just for fun. The lady's face had all the charm of a snow shovel. Her hair, an unremarkable and lifeless shade of brown, was mostly covered by a kerchief which was knotted severely under her wide chin. She surveyed the interior of the store for a moment or two, her small, deep-set eyes flicking here and there, like the eyes of a gunslinger who surveys the interior of a saloon before pushing all the way through the batwing doors and starting to raise hell. Then she came in. Few of the women circulating among the displays gave her more than a glance, but Nettie Cobb looked up at the newcomer with an extraordinary expression of mingled dismay and hate. Then she scuttled away from the carnival glass. Her movement caught the newcomer's eye. She glanced at Nettie with a kind of massive contempt, then dismissed her. The bell over the door jingled as Nettie left the shop. Mr. Gaunt observed all this with great interest. He walked over to Rosalie and said, Mrs. Cobb has left without you, I'm afraid. Rosalie looked startled. Why? She began, and then her eyes settled on the newcomer with the Casino Night button pinned adamantly between her breasts. She was studying the Turkish rug hung on the wall with the fixed interest of an art student in a gallery. Her hands were planted on her vast hips.
Oh, Rosalie said, excuse me, I really ought to go along.
No love lost between those two, I'd say, Mr. Gaunt remarked. Rosalie smiled distractedly.
Gaunt glanced at the woman in the kerchief again. Who is she? Rosalie wrinkled her nose. Wilma Jurzik, she said. Excuse me, I really ought to catch up with Nettie. She's high-strung, you know.
Of course, he said, and watched Rosalie out the door. To himself, he added, aren't we all?
Then Cora Rusk was tapping him on the shoulder. How much is that picture of the king? She demanded.
Leland Gaunt turned his dazzling smile upon her.
Well, let's talk about it, he said. How much do you think it's worth?
Castle Rock's newest port of commerce had been closed for nearly 2 hours when Alan Pangborn rolled slowly down Main Street toward the municipal building, which housed the sheriff's office and the Castle Rock Police Department. He was behind the wheel of the ultimate unmarked car, a 1986 Ford Town and Country station wagon, the family car. He felt low and half-drunk. He'd only had 3 beers, but they'd hit him hard. He glanced at Needful Things as he drove past, approving of the dark green canopy which jutted out over the street, just as Brian Rusk had done. He knew less about such things, having no relations who worked for the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, but he thought it did lend a certain touch of class to Main Street, where most shop owners had added false fronts and called it good. He didn't know yet what the new place sold, Pollywood, if she had gone over this morning as she had planned, but it looked to Alan like one of those cozy French restaurants where you took the girl of your dreams before trying to sweet-talk her into bed. The place slipped from his mind as soon as he passed it. He signaled left a block farther down and turned up the narrow passage between the squat brick block of the municipal building and the white clapboard water district building. This lane was marked Official Vehicles Only. The municipal building was shaped like an upside-down L, and there was a small parking lot in the angle formed by the 2 wings. 3 of the slots were marked Sheriff's Office. Norris Ridgwick's bumbling old VW Beetle was parked in one of them. Alan parked in another, cut the headlights in the motor, reached for the door handle. The depression, which had been circling him ever since he left the Blue Door in Portland, circling the way wolves often circled campfires in the adventure stories he had read as a boy, suddenly fell upon him. He let go of the door handle and just sat behind the wheel of the station wagon, hoping it would pass. He had spent the day in Portland's district court, testifying for the prosecution in 4 straight trials. The district encompassed 4 counties, York, Cumberland, Oxford, Castle, and of all the lawmen who served in those counties, Alan Pangborn had the furthest to travel. The 3 district judges therefore tried as best they could to schedule his court cases in bunches, so he would have to make the trip only once or twice a month. This made it possible for him to actually spend some time in the county, which he had sworn to protect, instead of on the roads between Castle Rock and Portland, but it also meant that, after one of his court days, he felt like a high school kid stumbling out of the auditorium where he had just taken the scholastic aptitude tests. He should have known better than to drink on top of that, but Harry Cross and George Crompton had just been on their way down to the Blue Door, and they had insisted that Alan join them. There had been a good enough reason to do so, a string of clearly related burglaries which had occurred in all their areas. But the real reason he had gone was the one most bad decisions have in common. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. Now he sat behind the wheel of what had been the family car, reaping what he had sown of his own free will. His head ached gently. He felt more than a touch of nausea, but the depression was the worst. It was back with a vengeance.
"Hello!" it cried merrily from its stronghold inside his head. "Here I am, Alan. Good to see you. Guess what? Here it is, end of a long, hard day, and Annie and Todd are still dead. Remember the Saturday afternoon when Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat? Right under where your briefcase is now, wasn't it? And you shouted at him? Wow! Didn't forget that, did you? You did? Well, that's okay, Alan, because I'm here to remind you, and remind you, and remind you."
He lifted his briefcase and looked fixedly at the seat. Yes, the stain was there, and yes, he had shouted at Todd.
"Todd, why do you always have to be so clumsy?"
Something like that, no big deal, but not the sort of thing you would ever say,
if you knew your kid had less than a month to live. It occurred to him that the beers weren't the real problem. It was this car, which had never been properly cleaned out. He had spent the day riding with the ghosts of his wife and his younger son. He leaned over and popped the glove compartment to get his citation book. Carrying that, even when he was headed down to Portland to spend the day testifying in court, was an unbreakable habit, and reached inside. His hand struck some tubular object, and it fell out onto the floor of the station wagon with a little thump. He put his citation book on top of his briefcase and then bent over to get whatever it was he had knocked out of the glove compartment. He held it up so it caught the glow of the arc sodium light and stared at it for a long time, feeling the old dreadful ache of loss and sorrow steal into him. Polly's arthritis was in her hands. His, it seemed, was in his heart, and who could say which of them had gotten the worst of it? The can had belonged to Todd, of course, Todd, who would have undoubtedly lived in the Auburn novelty shop if he had been allowed. The boy had been entranced with the cheap jack arcana sold there. Joy buzzers, sneezing powder, dribble glasses, soap that turned the user's hands to the color of volcanic ash, plastic dog turds. This thing is still here. 19 months they've been dead, and it's still here. How in hell did I miss it? Christ! Alan turned the round can over in his hands, remembering how the boy had pleaded to be allowed to buy this particular item with his allowance money, how Alan himself had demurred, quoting his own father's proverb, "The fool and his money soon parted," and how Annie had overruled him in her gentle way. "Listen to you, Mr. Amateur Magician, sounding like a Puritan. I love it. Where do you think he got this insane love of gags and tricks in the first place? No one in my family ever kept a framed picture of Houdini on the wall, believe me. Do you want to tell me you didn't buy a dribble glass or two in the hot wild days of your youth? That you wouldn't have just about died to own the old snake in the can of nuts trick if you'd come across one in a display case somewhere?" He, hemming and hawing, sounding more and more like a pompous stuffed shirt windbag. Finally, he had had to raise a hand to his mouth to hide a grin of embarrassment. Annie had seen it, however. Annie always did. That had been her gift, and more than once, it had been his salvation. Her sense of humor, and her sense of perspective as well, had always been better than his, sharper. "Let him have it, Alan. He'll only be young once, and it is sort of funny." So he had, and 3 weeks after that, he spilled his milkshake on the seat, and 4 weeks after that, he was dead. They were both dead. Wow! Imagine that! Time surely does fly by, doesn't it, Alan? But don't worry. Don't worry, because I'll keep reminding you. Yes, sir, I'll keep reminding you, because that's my job, and I mean to do it. The can was labeled Tasty Munch Mixed Nuts. Alan twisted off the top, and 5 feet of compressed green snake leaped out, struck the windshield, and rebounded into his lap. Alan looked at it, heard his dead son's laughter inside his head, and began to cry. His weeping was undramatic, silent, and exhausted. It seemed that his tears had a lot in common with the possessions of his dead loved ones. You never got to the end of them. There were too many, and just when you started to relax and think that it was finally over, the joint was clean, you found one more, and one more, and one more. Why had he let Todd buy the goddamn thing? Why was it still in the goddamn glove compartment? And why had he taken the goddamn town and country wagon in the first place? He pulled his handkerchief out of his back pocket and mopped the tears from his face. Then, slowly, he jammed the snake, just cheap green crepe paper with a metal spring wound up inside it, back into the bogus mixed nuts can. He screwed on the top and bounced the can thoughtfully on his hand. Throw the goddamn thing away. But he didn't think he could do that. Not tonight, at least. He tossed the joke, the last one Todd had ever bought in what he considered the world's finest store, back into the glove compartment and slammed the hatch shut. Then he took hold of the door handle again, grabbed his briefcase, and got out. He breathed deeply of the early evening air, hoping it would help. It didn't. He could smell decomposed wood and chemicals, a charmless odor which drifted down regularly from the paper mills in Rumford, some 30 miles north. He would call Polly and ask her if he could come over, he decided. That would help a little. A truer thought was never thunk.
the voice of depression agreed energetically. And by the way, Alan, do you remember how happy that snake made him? He tried it on everyone. Just about scared Norris Ridgwick into a heart attack, and you laughed until you almost wet your pants. Remember? Wasn't he lively? Wasn't he great? And Annie, remember how she laughed when you told her? She was lively and great, too, wasn't she? Of course, she wasn't quite as lively at the very end. Not quite as great, either. But you didn't really notice, did you? Because you had your own fish to fry. The business with Thad Beaumont, for instance. You really couldn't get that off your mind. What happened at their house by the lake, and how, after it was all over, he used to get drunk and call you. And then his wife took the twins and left him. All of that added to the usual around-town stuff kept you pretty busy, didn't it? Too busy to see what was happening right at home. Too bad you didn't see it. If you had, why, they might still be alive. That's something you shouldn't forget either, and so I'll just keep reminding you, and reminding you, and reminding you, okay? Okay.
There was a foot-long scratch along the side of the wagon, just above the gasoline port. Had that happened since Annie and Todd died? He couldn't really remember, and it didn't matter much anyway. He traced his fingers along it and reminded himself again to take the car to Sunny Sunoco and get it fixed. On the other hand, why bother? Why not just take the damn thing down to Harry Ford in Oxford and trade it in on something smaller? The mileage on it was still relatively low. He could probably get a decent trade-in. But Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat. The voice in his head piped up indignantly. He did that when he was alive, Alan, old buddy. And Annie... Oh, shut up, he said. He reached the building, then paused. Parked close by, so close that the office door would have dented in its side if pulled all the way open, was a large red Cadillac Seville. He didn't need to look at the license plates to know what they were. Keaton won. He ran a hand thoughtfully over the car's smooth hide, then went in. Sheila Brigham was sitting in the glass-walled dispatcher's cubicle, reading People magazine and drinking a Yoo-Hoo. The combined sheriff's office, Castle Rock Police Department, was otherwise deserted except for Norris Ridgwick. Norris sat behind an old IBM electric typewriter, working on a report with the agonized, breathless concentration only Norris could bring to paperwork. He would stare fixedly at the machine, then abruptly lean forward like a man who has been punched in the belly, and hit the keys in a rattling burst. He remained in his hunched position long enough to read what he had written, then groaned softly. There was the click-rap, click-rap, click-rap sound of Norris using the IBM's correct tape to back over some error. He used one correct tape per week on the average, and then Norris would straighten up. There would be a pregnant pause, and then the cycle would repeat itself. After an hour or so of this, Norris would drop the finished report into Sheila's in-basket. Once or twice a week, these reports were even intelligible. Norris looked up and smiled as Alan crossed the small bullpen area. "Hi, boss. How's it going?" "Well, Portland's out of the way for another 2 or 3 weeks. Anything happen here?" "Nah, just the usual. You know, Alan, your eyes are red as hell. Have you been smoking that wacky tobacco again?" "Ha-ha," Alan said sourly. "I stopped for a couple of drinks with a couple of cops, then stared at people's high beams for 30 miles. You got your aspirin handy?" "Always," Norris said. "You know that." Norris's bottom desk drawer contained his own private pharmacy. He opened it, rummaged, produced a giant-sized bottle of strawberry-flavored Kaopectate, stared at the label for a moment, shook his head, dropped it back into the drawer, and rummaged some more. At last, he produced a bottle of generic aspirin. "I've got a little job for you," Alan said, taking the bottle and shaking two aspirins into his hand. A lot of white dust fell out with the pills, and he found himself wondering why generic aspirin always produced more dust than brand-name aspirin. He wondered further if he might be losing his mind. "Ah, Alan, I got two more of these E9 boogers to do, and..." "Cool your jets." Alan went to the water cooler and pulled a paper cup from the cylinder screwed to the wall. "Blub, blub, blub," went the water cooler as he filled the cup. "All you've got to do is cross the room and open the door I just came through. So simple, even a child could do it, right?" "What?" "Only, don't forget to take your citation book," Alan said, and gulped the aspirin down. Norris Ridgwick immediately looked wary. "Yours is right there on the desk, next to your briefcase." "I know, and that's where it's going to stay, at least for tonight." Norris looked at him for a long time. Finally, he asked, "Buster?" Alan nodded. "Buster. He's parked in the goddamn crypt space again. I told him last time I was through warning him about it."
Castle Rock's head selectman, Danforth Keaton III, was referred to as Buster by all who knew him. But municipal employees who wanted to hold on to their jobs made sure to call him Dan or Mr. Keaton when he was around. Only Alan, who was an elected official, dared call him Buster to his face, and he had done it only twice, both times when he was very angry. He supposed he would do it again, however. Dan Buster Keaton was a man Alan Pangborn found it very easy to get angry at.
"Come on," Norris said. "You do it, Alan, okay?"
"Can't. I've got that appropriations meeting with the selectman next week."
"He hates me already," Norris said morbidly. "I know he does."
"Buster hates everyone except his wife and his mother," Alan said, "and I'm not so sure about his wife. But the fact remains that I have warned him at least half a dozen times in the last month about parking in our one and only handicapped space, and now I'm going to put my money where my mouth is."
"No, I'm going to put my job where your mouth is. This is really mean, Alan. I'm sincere."
Norris Ridgwick looked like an ad for "When Bad Things Happen to Good People."
"Relax," Alan said. "You put a $5 parking ticket on his windshield, he comes to me, and first he tells me to fire you."
Norris moaned.
"I refuse. Then he tells me to tear up the ticket. I refuse that, too. Then, tomorrow noon, after he's had a chance to froth at the mouth about it for a while, I relent. And when I go into the next appropriations meeting, he owes me a favor."
"Yeah, but what does he owe me?"
"Norris, do you want a new pulse radar gun or not?"
"Well,
and what about a fax machine? We've been talking about a fax machine for at least 2 years."
"Yes," the falsely cheerful voice in his mind cried. "You started talking about it when Annie and Todd were still alive, Alan. Remember that? Remember when they were still alive?"
"I guess," Norris said. He reached for his citation book with sadness and resignation writ large upon his face.
"Good man," Alan said with a heartiness he didn't feel. "I'll be in my office for a while."
He closed the door and dialed Polly's number. "Hello?" she asked, and he knew immediately that he would not tell her about the depression which had come over him with such smooth completeness. Polly had her own problems tonight. It had taken only that single word to tell him how it was with her. The L sounds in hello were lightly slurred. That only happened when she had taken a Percodan, or perhaps more than one, and she took a Percodan only when the pain was very bad. Although she had never come right out and said so, Alan had an idea she lived in terror of the day when the perks would stop working. "How are you, pretty lady?" he asked, leaning back in his chair and putting a hand over his eyes. The aspirin didn't seem to be doing much for his head. "Maybe I should ask her for a perk," he thought.
"I'm all right." He heard the careful way she was speaking, going from one word to the next, like a woman using stepping stones to cross a small stream.
"How about you? You sound tired."
"Lawyers do that to me every time."
He shelved the idea of going over to see her. She would say, "Of course, Alan," and she would be glad to see him, almost as glad as he would be to see her, but it would put more strain on her than she needed this evening.
"I think I'll go home and turn in early. Do you mind if I don't come by?"
"No, honey, it might be a little better if you didn't, actually."
"Is it bad tonight?"
"It's been worse," she said carefully.
"That's not what I asked."
"Not too bad, no."
"Your own voice says you're a liar, my dear," he thought.
"Good. What's the deal on that ultrasonic therapy you told me about? Find anything out?"
"Well, it would be great if I could afford a month and a half in the Mayo Clinic, on spec, but I can't. And don't tell me you can, Alan, because I'm feeling a little too tired to call you a liar."
"I thought you said Boston Hospital."
"Next year," Polly said. "They're going to run a clinic using ultrasound therapy next year. Maybe."
There was a moment of silence, and he was about to say goodbye when she spoke again. This time her tone was a little brighter. "I dropped by the new shop this morning. I had Nettie make a cake and took that. Pure orneriness, of course. Ladies don't take baked goods to openings. It's practically graven in stone."
"What's it like? What does he sell?"
"A little bit of everything. If you put a gun to my head, I'd say it's a curios and collectibles shop, but it really defies description. You'll have to see it for yourself."
"Did you meet the owner?"
"Mr. Leland Gaunt from Akron, Ohio," Polly said, and now Alan could actually hear the hint of a smile in her voice. He's going to be quite the heartthrob in Castle Rock's smart set this year. That's my prediction, anyway. What did you make of him? When she spoke again, the smile in her voice came through even more clearly. Well, Alan, let me be honest. You're my darling, and I hope I'm yours, but you are, he said. His headache was lifting a little. He doubted if it was Norris Ridgewick's aspirin working this small miracle. But he made my heart go pity-pat, too, and you should have seen Rosalie and Nettie when they came back. Nettie? He took his feet off the desk and sat up. Nettie scared of her own shadow. Yes, but since Rosalie persuaded her to go down with her, you know the poor old dear won't go anywhere alone, I asked Nettie what she thought of Mr. Gaunt after I got home this afternoon. Alan, her poor old muddy eyes just lit up. He's got carnival glass, she said. Beautiful carnival glass. He even invited me to come back tomorrow and look at some more. I think it's the most she said to me all at once in about 4 years. So I said, wasn't that kind of him, Nettie? And she said, yes. And do you know what? I asked her what, of course, and Nettie said, and I just might go. Alan laughed loud and heartily. If Nettie's willing to go see him without a duenna, I ought to check him out. The guy must really be a charmer. Well, it's funny. He's not handsome, or at least not in a movie star way, but he's got the most gorgeous hazel eyes. They light up his whole face. Watch it, lady, Alan growled. My jealous muscle is starting to twitch. She laughed a little. I don't think you have to worry. There's one other thing, though. What's that? Rosalie said Wilma Jurzik came in while Nettie was there. Did anything happen? Were words passed? No. Nettie glared at the Jurzik woman, and she kind of curled her lip at Nettie, that's how Rosalie put it, and then Nettie scurried out. Has Wilma Jurzik called you about Nettie's dog lately? No, Alan said. No reason to. I've cruised past Nettie's house after 10 half a dozen nights over the last 6 weeks or so. The dog doesn't bark anymore. It was just the kind of thing puppies do, Polly. It's grown up a little, and it has a good mistress. Nettie may be short on little furniture on the top floor, but she's done her duty by that dog. What does she call it? Raider. Well, Wilma Jurzik will just have to find something else to bitch about because Raider is squared away. She will, though. Ladies like Wilma always do. It was never the dog anyway, not really. Wilma was the only person in the whole neighborhood who complained. It was Nettie. People like Wilma have noses for weakness, and there's a lot to smell on Nettie Cobb. Yes. Polly sounded sad and thoughtful. You know that Wilma Jurzik called her up one night and told her that if Nettie didn't shut the dog up, she'd come over and cut its throat. Well, Alan said evenly, I know that Nettie told you so, but I also know that Wilma frightened Nettie very badly, and that Nettie has had problems. I'm not saying Wilma Jurzik isn't capable of making a call like that, because she is, but it might have only been in Nettie's mind. That Nettie had had problems was understating by quite a little bit, but there was no need to say more. They both knew what they were talking about. After years of hell, married to a brute who abused her in every way a man can abuse a woman, Nettie Cobb had put a meat fork in her husband's throat as he slept. She had spent 5 years in Juniper Hill, a mental institution near Augusta. She had come to work for Polly as part of a work release program. As far as Alan was concerned, she could not possibly have fallen in with better company, and Nettie's steadily improving state of mind confirmed his opinion. 2 years ago, Nettie had moved into her own little place on Ford Street, 6 blocks from downtown. Nettie's got problems, all right, Polly said, but her reaction to Mr. Gaunt was nothing short of amazing. It really was awfully sweet. I do have to get in and see this guy for myself, Alan said. Tell me what you think. And check out those hazel eyes. I doubt if they'll cause the same reaction in me that they seem to have caused in you, Alan said dryly. She laughed again, but this time he thought it sounded slightly forced. Try to get some sleep, he said. I will. Thanks for calling, Alan. Welcome. He paused. I love you, pretty lady. Thank you, Alan. I love you, too. Good night. Good night. He racked the telephone, twisted the gooseneck of the desk lamp so it threw a spot of light on the wall, put his feet up on his desk, and brought his hands together in front of his chest, as if praying. He extended his index fingers. On the wall, a shadow rabbit poked up its ears. Alan slipped his thumbs between his extended fingers, and the shadow rabbit wiggled its nose. Alan made the rabbit hop across the makeshift spotlight.
What lumbered back was an elephant wagging its trunk. Alan's hands moved with a dexterous, eerie ease. He barely noticed the animals he was creating. This was an old habit with him, his way of looking at the tip of his nose and saying om. He was thinking about Polly. Polly and her poor hands. What to do about Polly? If it had been just a matter of money, he would have had her checked into a room at the Mayo Clinic by tomorrow afternoon, signed, sealed, and delivered. He would have done it, even if it meant wrapping her in a straitjacket and shooting her full of sedative to get her out there. But it wasn't just a matter of money. Ultrasound as a treatment for degenerative arthritis was in its infancy. It might eventually turn out to be as effective as the Salk vaccine, or as bogus as the science of phrenology. Either way, it didn't make sense right now. The chances were 1,000 to 1 that it was a dry hole. It was not the loss of money he dreaded, but Polly's dashed hopes. A crow, as limber and lifelike as a crow in a Disney animated cartoon, flapped slowly across his framed Albany Police Academy graduation certificate. Its wings lengthened, and it became a prehistoric pterodactyl, triangular head cocked as it cruised toward the filing cabinets in the corner and out of the spotlight. The door opened. The doleful basset hound face of Norris Ridgwick poked through. "I did it, Alan," he said, sounding like a man confessing to the murder of several small children. "Good, Norris," Alan said. "You're not going to get hit with the shit on this either. I promise." Norris looked at him for a moment longer with his moist eyes, then nodded doubtfully. He glanced at the wall. "Do Buster, Alan." Alan grinned, shook his head, and reached for the lamp. "Come on," Norris coaxed. "I ticketed his damn car. I deserve it. Do Buster, Alan. Please, that wipes me out." Alan glanced over Norris's shoulder, saw no one, and curled one hand against the other. On the wall, a stout shadow man stalked across the spotlight, belly swinging. He paused once to hitch up his shadow pants in the back and then stalked on, head turning truculently from side to side. Norris's laughter was high and happy, the laughter of a child. For one moment, Alan was reminded forcibly of Todd, and then he shoved that away. There had been enough of that for one night, please God.
"Jeez! That slays me," Norris said, still laughing. "You were born too late, Alan. You could have had a career on the Ed Sullivan Show."
"Go on," Alan said. "Get out of here."
Still laughing, Norris pulled the door closed. Alan made Norris, skinny and a little self-important, walk across the wall, then snapped off the lamp and took a battered notebook from his back pocket. He thumbed through it until he found a blank page and wrote, "Needful things." Below that, he jotted, "Leland Gaunt, Cleveland, Ohio." Was that right? No. He scratched out Cleveland and wrote Akron. Maybe I really am losing my mind, he thought. On a third line, he printed, "Check it out." He put his notebook back in his pocket, thought about going home, and turned on the lamp again instead. Soon the shadow parade was marching across the wall once more. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Like Sandberg's fog, the depression crept back on small, feline feet. The voice began speaking about Annie and Todd again. After a while, Alan Pangborn began to listen to it. He did it against his will, but with growing absorption. Polly was lying on her bed, and when she finished talking with Alan, she turned over on her left side to hang up the telephone. It fell out of her hand and crashed to the floor instead. The princess phone's base slid slowly across the night table, obviously meaning to join its other half. She reached for it, and her hand struck the edge of the table instead. A monstrous bolt of pain broke through the thin web the painkiller had stretched over her nerves and raced all the way up to her shoulder. She had to bite down on her lips to stifle a cry. The telephone base fell off the edge of the table and crashed with a single cling of the bell inside. She could hear the steady idiot buzz of the open line drifting up. It sounded like a hive of insects being broadcast via short wave. She thought of picking the telephone up with the claws which were now cradled on her chest, having to do it not by grasping, tonight her fingers would not bend at all, but by pressing, like a woman playing the accordion, and suddenly it was too much. Even something as simple as picking up a telephone which had fallen on the floor was too much, and she began to cry. The pain was fully awake again, awake and raving, turning her hands, especially the one she had bumped, into fever pits. She lay on her bed, looking up at the ceiling through her blurry eyes and wept. Oh, I would give anything to be free of this, she thought. I would give anything, anything, anything at all. By 10 o'clock on an autumn weeknight, Castle Rock's main street was as tightly locked up as a Chubb safe. The street lamps threw circles of white light on the sidewalk and the fronts of the business buildings in diminishing perspective, making downtown look like a deserted stage set. Soon, you might think, a lone figure dressed in tails and a top hat, Fred Astaire or maybe Gene Kelly, would appear and dance his way from one of those spots to the next, singing about how lonely a fellow could be when his best girl had given him the air and all the bars were closed. Then, from the other end of Main Street, another figure would appear, Ginger Rogers or maybe Sid Charisse, dressed in an evening gown. She would dance toward Fred, or Jean, singing about how lonely a gal could be when her best guy had stood her up. They would see each other, pause artistically, and then dance together in front of the bank or maybe you so-and-so. Instead, Hugh Priest hove into view. He did not look like either Fred Astaire or Gene Kelly. There was no girl at the far end of Main Street advancing toward a romantic chance meeting with him, and he most definitely did not dance. He did drink, however, and he had been drinking steadily in the Mellow Tiger since 4 that afternoon. At this point in the festivities, just walking was a trick, and never mind any fancy dance steps. He walked slowly, passing through one pool of light after another, his shadow running tall across the fronts of the barber shop, the Western Auto, the video rental shop.